Thank you, Dave.
Good afternoon. I'm glad so many of you could make it through the traffic that was out there. I was driving in. I left about 9 a.m. this morning to come down the Schuylkill. Just got here. I'm Art Kaplan from the Center for Bioethics, and it's great to see so many of you at this colloquium plus graduation event. I think you have a great treat in store for you. I was talking to Rita, and she was saying, you know, I'm a little surprised that I got asked to do this talk. And I said, why? And she said, well, you know, I do medical humanities work. She's a physician and also has a degree in English. She's been known in some ways as the, I guess you'd say, the mother of narrative work in medical ethics and to some extent in medicine itself. And I said, no, we do a lot of that work. There's a lot of people who are interested in those areas. We've always had courses and people looking at medical humanities subjects. And for those of you who aren't insiders to this, this is the difference between doing normative ethics and telling people what they ought to do, and then telling stories that people actually pay attention to learn what they ought to do. So, you know, long ago I learned that people respond very well and listen and learn from stories. That generally is how we learn about ethics, not usually through some kind of long principled deontological argument bottom. But nonetheless, I myself, coming out of a philosophy background, have a training in that direction. But I get the fact that there is much to be learned from doing narrative and literary work. In addition, Rita, I should mention, is the co-editor of the Journal of Literature and Medicine. And I think she's the editor of a co-editor of a book, if I remember right, on Why Stories Matter. Did I get that title right? I've known her for a long, long time. I actually preceded her, however, at Columbia. You might say I laid the groundwork for her to repair things and then move forward. Way, way back when I was at the medical school there, we were just trying to get bioethics underway, and we weren't thinking about using literature, and we weren't thinking about the arts, and we weren't thinking about film, and we weren't thinking about ways we could integrate work with even anthropology or the social sciences. All that's changed. We do think that way all the time now. Many of you know the Bioethics Center is often quick to try and integrate the appearance of a play or a film with a meeting or a discussion on different topics. And I think you're in for a treat now in listening to Rita's presentation. So I'm going to turn the floor over to her. I'm sure she'll take some questions at the end of her remarks. And I'm very, very appreciative that she's with us today.
Thank you. See, I am merely reaping the harvest. So, we are so lucky to be in this field. Congratulations first to those of you receiving the master's degree. I know that for some it's taken a year, for some two, for some five, for some seven. I know, like our master's students in narrative medicine, that many of you receiving this degree are also full-time dentists and nurses and doctors and veterinarians and lawyers and judges and social workers. I know that. And it speaks to us old-timers like nothing else about the necessity for these fields, the necessity and the beauty of them. What would possess a successful pediatrician into a multi-year, daunting, challenging, gripping, expensive effort to train, I'm not going to say retrain, to additionally train in fields of thinking, in fields of reading, in fields of knowing in ways that are different from that which one knows as a doctor, nurse, social worker, journalist, lawyer. And it's as we look at you that we get what has happened to this field. It's very different from what it used to be. The weight that becoming an ethicist today carries, I believe, is different. It used to be a rather simple, uncomplicated moral weight, that the ethicist was the one who helped patients and families make choices. And the ethicist could have been confused with the chaplain, probably, early on. In fact, it was the ministers who were at the beginning ground for what we now call bioethics. And so from this relatively uncomplicated moral weight, we've become as pluripotent as these stem cells that some of you study. And, you know, some of us, I look at the website for the center, and it's bristling with all this nanotechnology and stem cell, and can you patent a gene, and NASA, and all of these science-using questions. It's a big shift. It's a kind of tectonic shift. And that part of the effort, and many of you, I think, are involved in that, that part is, if you will, cooler. Do you know what I mean? It's cool. There's a cool analytic. It's kind of titanium, right? And alongside it is also this warmer, maybe hotter, moral enterprise that still has to do with patients and dying people and quandaries about living and dying. I think the questions that come to us are different. We used to be asked who should get dialyzed, and that was kind of it. Today we're asked about conflicts of interest among scientist investors, right? We're asked about genetic favoritism. We're asked ethico-political questions about global health, social justice, responsibilities of the developed world toward the developing world. We're the ones who have to explain why disaster tourism is a bad thing, right? We have to explain what medical exoticism is and why not to do it. I'm prepared for us to get very involved in environmental survival, right? Carbon footsteps, anybody? This is the next big thing, I think. The growing, I love my sentence, growing one's own garden of pluripotent stem cells just in case. You know, do we do that? Should we do it now? I don't know. Here's another phrase I liked. The interpersonal ethics of robotic surgeons, right? All the ways in which the giving of care have become foreign. And we're the ones who are going to figure out how does the robot vascular surgeon get along with the robot cardiac surgeon? I'm really not sure what the etiquette is. But, you know, we're the ones who are going to work that out. So what I'm saying is that the very continents with which you all get to make contact are different. It's not just the continent of religion, faith, pain at the end of life. It's all these continents about national politics, State Department, NASA, making the work we do all the more, fun, but also with all the more at stake, without losing that aspect of the individual patient. You know, we're not giving over because we like the, you know, futuristic hocus pocus. We're not giving over the aspect of our work, which is, I think, the center of it. The center still holds at the bedside where a sick person is trying to die a death that fits the life lived, or an ill person is seeking the center that confers meaning on what's left of life. And so, indeed, we are all not only interested in and fluent in and committed to, but also respectful of the narratives of illness, the ways in which the sick person and the caregivers tell of that which befalls us. We understand it's complicated. We understand it's not easy to read The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. We know that. It's much harder to write it, to blink it. We know that. And so this becomes, if the one is cool titanial, this is, I didn't even write down a description for it, but it's mercurial, right? It's hot and moving and ever forming. So that we as ethicists trained in the inside of language, yes? How to use it, how to read it, how to get it. We can do all these things for persons who are sick and for persons caring for those who are sick in the very attention that we're able to mount for the stories that we hear. We know, we all disagree. Can I say this at Penn? We all disagree with Elaine Scarry. She started here. She went to Harvard. She started here. She's the one who said in The Body in Pain, but there is no language for pain. We know she's wrong. We know there is a language for pain. What's hard is to hear it. And we are the ones trained to hear it. This is what we do. We know things, I mean, we have anthropologists and we have gender studies and we have film scholars here, so we know things like how sex and gender influence health and illness. We know that the body speaks, the narrativity of the body. I'm gonna forgive me, but in a few pages I'm gonna talk biochemistry to you. Don't worry. But the very narrativity of the body is something that we can learn how to hear. We know how to see and appreciate and get the myths, the rituals, the cultural practices that surround health and illness, even our own. I'm a general internist. I have all these myths and rituals and practices. I don't see a patient without taking out a freshly ironed and laundered white sheet from my examining table and lay it out with some fanfare, even just to what? To feel a belly or listen to a heart, it doesn't matter. It's the fanfare of the draping and the fluffing. Do you see what I mean? The practices we do as doctors, nurses, social workers, carers, are what convey our capacity to care for the ill person. So the fact that we study with the anthropologists about these rituals is indeed very, very meaningful. So the part of ethics that I represent is the part that deals with the singular, because I'm a literary scholar, and as such, I know how to read. I read very well. I read closely. Every word counts. I choose as my task today to simply let you in on some of the ways in which we in literary studies are thinking about the work of stories. How stories shape us, how they change our lives, what happens to them and to us when they're released into the space around us. Boy, I just made a mess here. So, in close reading, I find that I make points of contact with the text itself, with the protagonist in the text, with the text's narrator, and even with the flesh and blood author who wrote the text, even long dead. So I'm teaching Proust in my hospital literature seminar. We're reading the whole thing of Rishesh. We're reading the whole thing. We start at the beginning. We skipped a little of volume 5 and 6, but we mostly read the whole thing. And we're now in the last book. It's called Le Temps Retrouvé, which is the past recaptured. And by now, we know how to make contact, not only with the aging Marcel, who is the protagonist, who brings us the story in the later volumes of the World War I deaths, This is the culture shift in Europe at that time, the Parisian salon scene, but also with Marcel Proust, the man, lying in his cork-lined room, brooding about the relationship between the real and the imagined, emanating to us, to me, the reader, holding the book through the words. When the words are those spoken by a sick person to me in the office, in the medicine clinic, I'm duty-bound to receive that language, to take it in, to interpret its possible meanings, to answer. Some people call this listening and receiving and responding to the language of pain the soft stuff of clinical medicine. I'm never sure why that's the case, whether you're the internist or the vascular surgeon or the ethicist. It's the hardest part imaginable of taking care of patients. It means you have to be present with sick and dying people, with your full self, your sense of the tragic not blunted by calculation, your measure of loss not dwarfed by detachment. There's nothing soft about that. It is this meeting between the sick person and the ones or the one who cares for that sick person where the two people matter, where the singularity of this meeting takes hold. Young medical students get nervous when we say, oh no, not every doctor does the same thing. They get very nervous. They think there's a right thing to do, and soon enough they'll know it. And I have to say, there is no universality. And if you happen to get Dr. Lerner instead of Dr. Sharon, something different is gonna happen. You might leave the office with a different disease. You're certainly gonna leave the office with a different treatment, see? So the two persons there matter. Such contact takes place, and I'm trying, I don't think anyone in the room is excluded from this. This contact I'm talking about is between two persons, and it can take place in the clinical setting, in the policy setting, in the legal setting, in the setting of human subjects. It's two persons engaged in discourse. That's what I want to look at with you now. These two persons engaged in discourse are wrapped in their membranes of self. Yes? The membrane is the outside skin, the envelope, the envelope of the self. The borders of which are patrolled, though commerce is allowed through the gates. And anywhere any of you do work in ethics, again, whether it's clinical, gathering data about who goes to in vitro fertilization clinics, interviewing complainants in clinical trials fraud. I mean, all the aspects, even the cool titanium ones, you know, interviewing the nanotechnology inventor. All of these things stage contact between two persons, each with their membrane. Yes? Okay. I think the membranes, or the skin, that which separates us from one another, these membranes are particularly fraught in the kind of work we do in clashing values, in murky meanings, and contested claims. We're not talking about widgets. We're not talking about, the shade of lipstick we're gonna push in the Maybelline line. We're not talking about trivial things. The things that we deal with are high stakes. Now, I'm speaking about membranes for a reason. I like the parallel between the cellular membrane and the membrane between two persons talking. And I'm assuming that some of you know enough biology that you know how much goes on at the cell membrane, right? I'm going to bring you into a liver cell in a minute, but it's at the skin of every cell that the whole biochemical apparatus gets going, all right? I'm going to go into. I kind of feel a calling to do a little riff in biochemistry. So a cell has these receptors sticking out of its surface, and the receptors are like open hands, and they're shaped in a way that only one molecule can fit in it. That's a receptor, all right? But this receptor goes in through the membrane of the cell, and the bottom part of the receptor does things inside the cell. You see? Get the picture? So the hand is sticking up, open, waiting for the thing that fits in it. And as soon as the thing that fits in it docks, all kinds of business goes on inside the cell. All right? So this thing that docks is a big complicated molecule, like, say, insulin. All right? It's called the ligand. The ligand is the thing that docks to make things happen inside the cell. So once the membrane receptor is activated by its ligand, all sorts of things happen inside the cell to do work, to do work. So you have a liver cell, and it's got a receptor waiting for insulin. And an insulin molecule comes around and docks in it, okay? It's very docking on the insulin receptor changes the inside portion, causing cascades and cascades of biochemical enzymatic consequences inside the cell. And this is kind of hilarious. Just listen what happens when insulin docks on the receptor. Just listen what happens inside the liver cell. So as soon as it docks, it changes things inside so that, among many other things, it converts phosphatidyl inositol 4,5-bisphosphate into phosphatidyl inositol 3,4,5 triphosphate. See? Common thing. This change from the bisphosphate to the triphosphate activates a protein kinase, another enzyme, which turns off another enzyme, the glycogen synthase kinase 3. When that one is turned off, it cannot, in turn, turn off glycogen synthase. Got it? So the glycogen synthase, not being turned off by the thing that itself was turned off, is allowed to work. And that tells the cell to take in the glucose, turn it into a storage form, not let all the sugar pile up in the circulation and hurt your eyes and your kidneys. And that's how insulin controls your blood sugar. Now that's hilarious. This is the most bizarre Rube Goldbergian thing I've ever heard of. And this goes on, did you know this was going on at each of your million liver cells? Lewis Thomas said years ago, if you were put in charge of your liver, you'd be dead in a day. So now I'm saying that two people talking have membranes, and things happen at the membranes. What constitutes the ligands for the two people talking? What is my prolonged metaphor doing? We're talking. Art Kaplan and I are talking. My receptor, with its empty. Space is waiting for the ligand. What's the ligand? What's the ligand? I hope you know. The ligand is the story. Our ligands are stories. It is the stories that we hear that activate, that let us do the work of saving lives. See? So whether you're talking to Art Kaplan in the office, or you're talking to the inventor of some new nanotechnology thing, or if you're sitting with the daughter of a profoundly demented old woman with a big intracranial bleed, the ligand is the story. And it is that that will activate you into action. Stories and their receptors pierce the membrane of the reader, the listener, activating the system from the outside. The story's receptors, deep portions inside the reader, receiver, triggers not, you know, phosphorylation of the bisphosphate. What does it trigger? It triggers your responses of making meaning. It triggers your emotion, your cognition, your associations, your aesthetic sensibilities, your relation or relational capacity, your capacity for attention, your memory, your bliss. All of these things are activated by virtue of that ligand, by virtue of hearing that story from the demented old lady, sister, or daughter in the ICU. The story itself is altered by virtue of this activation, because that's going on your membrane, not Dr. Lerner's, right? We rely on having countless story receptors on our membranes, ready to be activated by new experience. I swear, Carol, this is why we teach literature in medical settings. This is why we teach literature, so that all of us are equipped with these receptors, all right? And we're ready. We know we have the bank of stories. We have Ivan Ilyich and Hans Kastorp and King Lear and Isabel Archer and Job. We're ready for them, right? And so when we're approached by another story that reminds us of them, we have something to go on, right? It's going to catch. It's going to be a ligand. It's going to make things happen on the inside. We're like poised to hear, to attend, to make connections, to ask questions, to get the meaning of the new story that maybe sounds like Isabel Archer or Job. Now, the new one is going to be unlike the old one, but at least we're on the road toward absorbing and understanding it by virtue of what's been done before. All right? I think these story ligands have less to do with empathy and more to do with the imagination, with vision, with curiosity, with the shift in perspective that comes to the artist or writer or reader. Stories help us to see through similarity, through difference, through allusion, through echoes. They work inside us to stir up recollection and recognition. A story can make the strange familiar. It can make the familiar strange. It can make the invisible visible. I think this explains the mechanism of dreams and parables and myths. And in our work, we know that the better we see, the better we can offer care. The better we imagine, the better we can comprehend and be with or join with those unlike us. Now, because I'm a clinician and I work around patients, I can't help but tell about some of what I've seen there. Nothing stands still in serious illness. The sick person finds himself or herself in that horrible foreign territory of MRIs and biopsies and stent placements and chemotherapy, the pilgrimages to the NIH or Mayo, the worldwide Dolatril in Mexico, the Lorenzo's oil in Rome. Families are transformed by sickness, and usually not for the better. Have you come to see that? You know, sickness is not a noble act, guys. It doesn't bring out the best in us, usually. The veil is raised on all kinds of situations, and we often see as those who see the exposure of the patient and family within serious illness, we see all the troubles and the sadnesses and the conflicts and the hostilities, as well as, of course, the great attachment and love. But it's not only nobling. Illness insists on a transit of the self, unbounded by dumb health, the self in illness, and either the sick person or those caring for that sick person, finds itself not only freed to, but required to, move into altered states. When one cares for a seriously ill person, in no matter what role, he or she is similarly launched onto perilous travel outside the self. We have to be able to move with patients and families through these journeys, these marathons, these forced migrations to the world of the ill. We must move not simply into the awareness of the fragility of health, but more transformingly and fundamentally and irrevocably into an identity with that ill person and into a position from which one must own up to not only the certainty of the self, but the certainty of its end. I've been writing lately about the self-telling body, because I'm trying to look carefully at this relationship between the body and the self and what it is that the body exposes about the self who dwells with it that otherwise can't be seen. The body is a portal to the self, gaining us access, if we're good at our work, to not only the physical situation of the patient, but deep, profound selfhood, there all the time, but exposed by illness or the ill state. Now, sometimes we who take care of the patient get marooned in the body, far away from its self-telling powers. So we exist in a paradox. We have to attend to the bodies. We have to take care of the heart and the lung and the skin and the intestines and the mind and the limbs. And yet we cannot risk severing the body from itself. So all of us, and I swear, this is why we come in to study fields like ethics and humanities within healthcare. I swear it's because of this. We know what happens. The nurses and caregivers, and I hope some of the doctors too, know what happens when you give a bed bath to someone. We know what happens when you examine the feet of an old woman. You hold in your hands the decades and decades of moving through life. You're examining the diabetic ulcer, but you're also examining the being planted on earth. And you hold that in your hand. I recently saw in the office a 78-year-old woman suffering from lung cancer at the end of a long and very remarkably successful run of treatment. We kept being astonished. I mean, the oncologist would call me. He'd say, "Rita, she responded." I mean, we didn't know why, but she got better. And the chemotherapy worked and the radiation worked. It was remarkable. I remember diagnosing her cancer many years ago, brought to my knees by the radiology report that first described her lung mass. It wasn't a feeling of guilt at the time, the way it so often is, but a deep and nameless sadness. These days, with her advanced lung cancer, she insists on getting her bone density scan and her mammogram. She asks me, what can she do to gain back the weight she's lost, knowing full well what the weight loss signifies. When I wonder why is she so keen to do these preventive things, I realize that she has a stake in a future that I don't yet see. Either her behavior reflects denial, or what I think is more true, it reveals an awareness that she has survived far beyond anyone's expectation, and maybe not only by virtue of what we did for her. She comes in one day with a sore foot. I think it was an Achilles tendonitis. I kneel on the floor in front of her and rub her foot. I spend quite a bit of time there, kneeling, massaging her painful foot and ankle and calf. She says it helps. The next time she comes in to see me, she says, "I have magic hands." Now, what is my task here with this dying woman? It's not really to massage her foot. It's to wait with her on the precipice of her illness. While the lung cancer death comes toward us, I will watch with her, not knowing if my being there with her will alter her weight. To stand with someone on such a precipice, the watcher or listener needs not only the wherewithal to hear all the languages of the body, the rawls in the lung, the murmurs in the heart, but also needs the capacity to admit that life will most certainly end. Part of the equipment for the clinical listener is exactly the courage to perceive and to confess that life will end. This courage is not easy to come by. And most of us, I think, who end up in healthcare kind of fudge it. We figure we're around sickness so much we must be immune by now. We figure we don't smoke, we don't drink, we don't pay for sex, we're going to be fine. I think most of us, and I think this is true of the clinicians and the ethicists too, most of us simply lower the head and plow onward in diagnosis and treatment without coming to terms with the meanings of illness or death. But those who work around illness and do develop their own sense of awareness of death can listen for the self-telling body. Not only might they hear this body tell of asthma or dementia or colon cancer, they will hear it tell of being lost in the cosmos, like a dropped star or a rogue planet. They will hear it tell of being shorn off, the jagged endings, the stumps of life. They will hear it tell, in rage and sorrow, of the leer of the disease that comes for it, from nowhere, landing at random in the midst of life, disfiguring life, replacing life's warmth and liveliness with nothing but cold pain and an empty future. Now, of course, I'm not being more maudlin or morbid than I need to be. Of course, we also see endurance and hope and belief in resurrection. We see all of this. But unless we can see that which is taken away, I think we cannot hear what we need to hear. So this is what I've called narrative medicine. This is medicine or practice fortified with the capacity to fully hear and receive that which sick people must say. To stand on the precipice with my 78-year-old woman means then that I have to be both her doctor and her witness. I have to bear witness to her full situation, the situation of being mortal. We know that doing this, bearing witness, being there with another who suffers, is a transformative act. As the observer of another's, not only as the observer of the other's situation, but one who becomes embedded in that situation, intimately bound as a partner, situated with the other now, watching and waiting together with the person whose life is ruptured by illness. At this point in engagement, the witness is transformed by the experience, now aware not just of the powers of observation, but the capacity for this contact that I've been describing. That which starts, activated by this ligand, this is where it gets. This is the phosphorylation, all right? The capacity to witness and watch and wait at that precipice. My rubbing of the feet of my 78-year-old woman declared that I was on her side, on my knees, honoring the steadfast vitality of this woman so close to death. She understands full well the limits of my magic, while I appreciate ever more deeply the courage and grace of her ongoingness. I was humbled by her disregard of medicine's so-called prognosis, as I was enraptured by her cosmic vision of hopefulness amid the despair. Now, there are times that people suffer disruptions so profound in illness that they can't even tell of them. I mean, we do our work in the face of these great disruptions. The ordinary life is interrupted. The child gets leukemia. The senior breaks her hip. The adolescent girl gets pregnant. The grandmother loses her mind. The young mother finds a breast lump. The infant is born with a damaged heart. And we who are supposed to take care of them have to enter these complicated narrative situations and at very least imagine what it is like to be so disrupted. And in the disruptions, we know that the one disrupted can sometimes not tell that which has happened. It's not just the person brutalized in Rwanda or Iraq who's unable to tell of the trauma. And we've learned a lot from trauma scholars that any headache clinic or irritable bowel program needs to help persons seeking care to tell of the suffering that has befallen them. So that we have to strengthen all of this business, the ligands, the phosphorylation, get it going, because it's that they're going to tell us in some way, if only through their body, right? A lot of wordless telling goes on, you know that? A lot of wordless telling goes on. We have to get that, even wordless telling, and somehow through our own machinery, make it so it can be heard. We have to reflect on and reflect back these stories, all right? We have to perceive the situation and then make that perception available to the patient who sometimes cannot see it, all right? So how do you do that? One means toward this double reflection, reflecting on and reflecting back. One way to get there is representation. We know from the work of writers and aesthetic theorists that when a writer represents complex events or states of affairs, he or she is not just recording them. You're not just writing it down. You're creating it. You're composing it. The writer is not the neutral recorder. The writer is the composer of that which is seen. When I describe my visit with my 78-year-old woman, I am, by virtue of the writing, able to see things I didn't see before I wrote it down. Hans Lowell, the psychoanalytic theorist, says that writing is a sensory-motor act by which one transforms the immaterial into the material, thereby being able to communicate it to self and to communicate it to others. Huh? I transform the immaterial into the material by virtue of writing it down. When I described that office visit that I just read to you, I placed myself spatially with this woman. I went out of my way to describe our spatial relations. I was on my knees in front of her. Being on one's knees and caring for another's feet, of course, has implications and illusions, yes? I was genuflecting in front of her. For those of you who grew up in Catholic Church, I was genuflecting in front of her, right? As I was genuflecting, it was only the 10th time I read this that I realized in that short little story, I was on my knees twice, wasn't I? Once when I heard the radiology report and once when I massaged her foot. So there I am in my body showing what I didn't know, which is that I understood the sacredness of what was happening. All right, to genuflect is an act of worship. All right, I didn't know that. And I didn't sit down at my computer and say, I think I'm going to write about the knees part. No, this is just how it came out. And then, because I'm a pretty good reader, I can see it. You see? Writing that memory let me confer form on the up until then formless memory and animated my own dormant sense of the sacred in this patient. And by looking at the shape, the words, the frame of the way that I wrote it, I was able to understand how, for example, how much I had been in it with her from the very beginning, right? I'm implicating myself from the very beginning. Now, I'm not representing her experience. What am I representing? I'm representing mine, right? I'm representing my experience. My writing is done in my own effort to see it, to behold it, beyond the restricted frame of my general medicine clinic, and to use that knowledge, that new knowledge, to correct lacunae in my own visual practice and my own clinical practice. There are risks of distortion. I'm just guessing, right? This is my own experience of what went on in that room. But such writing usually leads reflexively to more writing. So when I told this woman that I was writing, what happened last time? Remember you said I had magic hands? I told her I was writing about that. She said that she wanted to join me in doing that. And she knew I was doing this, and she got a kick out of it. However, she died before she was able to even actually read that, although I told her what was in it. She sought all the way through aggressive care, as I've said, of her disease, until the very end. She was brought into the emergency room near cardiac arrest. We tried to resuscitate her and failed. She lived a life with a vision of its future. She was futuristic until her death. This she chose, and this we tried to give her. So as I tell of her situation to you now, and as her story helps us to learn how to improve our own clinical practice, I do it with her permission, and also with her presence still very alive in my sight, as if we are now guaranteeing her that future that she sought. At Columbia, we write all over the place. We write with nurses and social workers and pediatric residents and OBGYN residents. I mean, it's just becoming the way in which kind of things work. And what we see in one of the oncology units, it's the doctors, the oncologists, the fellows, the nurses, the social workers, the chaplain, and often one of the administrators, and they're all together. Sometimes, in fact, another group, we also have patients and caregivers right in the same group. Doesn't matter. We're all writing about illness and our response to it. And what we find, it's not magic, it's just natural, that when we do this work, simply writing about the suffering that we perceive, we are able to get underneath the distinctions that usually divide us. Nurses and doctors don't always get along. Social workers and the insurance ladies don't always get along. When we bring persons together to write about their clinical practice and to read to one another, they get under those distinctions on the ground of the suffering itself. So let me close with my second metaphor. See, all I did was I brought you a few words, right? I want to talk about the title I gave this talk. So somebody called me, I don't know who, and said, what's the title for your talk? And nobody ever thinks about this ahead of time. And you know that you don't keep it in the inbox and say, I'll get back to it. You don't do that. You just give them a title. So this odd title, Moral Quickening in Story's Womb. That's the name of this talk. So what is that all about? I didn't know what it meant when I wrote it, but now I do. Here's what it means. So here's what I was trying to convey. There's something about our deep relationship with the story we hear and read. Moral quickening in story's womb, okay? So the story is the mother, the story has the womb. I'm kind of in it. You know what quickening means? When the fetus starts to move, it's like the first sign of life, right? So my moral sense is coming to fetal life inside the uterus of the story. Rita, that's weird. If my moral education occurs within the nurturance incubation of the story, then I must get imprinted somehow with the features of that story. If we quicken within our story's wombs, that means that the stories themselves are fertile, right? The story is pregnant. The story is fertile and producing young. So for us to be within the womb of that makes us too some kind of story, right? I'm the story begotten by the story I'm inside. So there's this whole lineage. It's not trivial that I read the Gospels or read Henry James, all of it, or read Proust. I'm being nurtured by those stories, do you see? I'm their progeny. As their reader, I'm their progeny. This is the lineage, the descendants, the inheritance. And if I call this the site of moral quickening, it reminds me that we come to have our moral compass not by reading rules, but by living through complex narrative situations that either ended well or badly, that had in them or lacked the just and the fair, that found within themselves perhaps some beauty. This is why we need our stories, that we choose them carefully and become who we are quickly, quickeningly, by virtue of them. So our hope is that increasing our avidity and skill for hearing the singular lived experiences of patients or clients or partners or subjects, the hearing or art in his office, that increasing our avidity and skill for hearing these stories will enable us to hear more accurately what each one says. If we have more accurate evidence about the individual person, we will allow for more fitting attention to that person's situation. As we improve our own mechanisms for hearing and interpreting stories, we can receive them more deeply into ourselves, examine them more critically, so as to be impressed, these stories that we hear, with some of the invisible as well as the visible, to let the immaterial become material, and to be available as one who honors these singular narratives of illness. And the dividend for us is that we, in this receptive pose, can bring our whole selves into the actions of our work, healing the divides we often experience within ourselves while providing recognition for those who might benefit from our attention. Conceived by stories, activated by stories, we unite with those we serve as storytellers all. Thank you. Liggins. They tell me there's a little time for questions. Please. Good. The EMR is your friend. The EMR, the electronic medical record, is your friend. It can find and it can display in any kind of format you want all the hemoglobin A1Cs since time immemorial. Mm. This is your friend. It used to be you had to get on the phone. Remember? You'd have to get on the phone to chemistry. You don't have to do that anymore. So in one way, the EMR is your friend. You don't have to call anybody in the clinic in ortho to find out does she need to get pinned or not. You just look in WebSys. Some of them are not forgiving. Some of the electronic medical records indeed reduce you to making check marks in boxes, and that's bad. Right? We don't like checklists. I think Charles Bosque is in the back. He doesn't like checklists. We know that, and he's right. But most of these electronic setups give you room to type. And all of us type faster than we write. And lo and behold, the typing is legible. So when I write a note, and it has, you know, it's got a list of the medicines, a list of the problems, that's all very good. You know, did she or didn't she get her Pneumovax? It's very good. But then when I write my note, I write it knowing that the patient's going to get a copy of whatever I write. So what I write in my clinic note makes sure to reflect accurately what we do in the office. And if we spend most of the time talking about the trip to the Dominican Republic, that's what goes in the note. And if we talk about the nephew who's becoming a pilot, that's what goes in the note. Do you see? And then you give that to the patient, she's able to remember what went on. Oftentimes it leads to the patient then writing back to me, which I treasure. Do you see? So I think it's awkward because you have to kind of turn your back and go do something at the bloody keyboard. But there are ways, you know, that the chair can come around and the patient can be there with you. There are some times that you cannot write in the EMR what's important, right? So when that's the case, you simply go to the notepad or Word and you write what is important to be that the patient told you that does not belong in the record. You make two copies, you give one to her, you keep one yourself, and then you delete. So that's how you do that. I think there are problems with it, and I think for persons who are not attuned to the uses of language, it's an easy out. So there's lots and lots of kind of get a load of this for us to do. But I don't think by necessity it's a bad thing. That's what I think. I hope I'm right. Please. I think that our bad habits and our colleagues' bad habits oughtn't discourage us. Yes. And what we need to do as the scholars in this field is look really, really smartly and carefully at exactly that situation. All right, that's a gorgeous laboratory, what you just described. And you call it the downregulation of the receptor, if you like. But that's exactly what it is. And not having the skill to realize it ain't the same story. Okay? It ain't just postpartum blues. You know? And I think it's going to depend on each site of training how to incorporate the skill that is currently lacking.
I'm just wondering if you could say something about what you make of the because we're different on the inside. It may be the same. It may be the same ligand, but you're a different cell. So that the same story can activate different responses in the receiver. The different receivers will hear a different story. So the old, tall, white, male, white-coated attending is simply not going to hear the same narrative as will the younger woman of color who comes in jeans. Thank God.
Is that okay? The story changes, though. Often the patient changes their stories.
Yeah.
Do people joke about going to attending school and knowing you get a great story?
Yeah. No. Usually the attending has at least one. Really? I think that we take this as helpful. It shows that these accounts are not kind of prescribed boilerplate, but rather each time this account is given, it is a fresh discourse. And the fresh discourse relies on the singularity of the discourse. And depending on your receptive skill, you will make possible a telling that may not be possible by someone who's less attentive or less patient or less fluent. You see? I mean, it's not just words. It's the silences and the stuttering and the tearfulness and the expressions and the turning away and all that business. So there's much more going on at that membrane besides the words. Sometimes it's only how am I feeling right now in her presence? Why am I feeling so sad? And that's the first key that, oh, she is depressed. So don't minimize your tremendous power as a receiver. And if you hear something different from the next guy, don't assume the next guy is brighter than you. It's complicated. Do you think that narrative medicine could be the answer to reattaching this concern and
CNA? Well, I think the detached concern was a protective device, and no doubt it is indeed simpler to care for people who were ill and dying with the cloak of detachment. And I think that we have somewhat inflated the requirement for the cold objectivity, in part to spare us the anguish of the engagement. And what's sad is that it is only through the engagement that the rewards are felt. So, I mean, this lady died, and all I did was massage her feet. But you can see how much tremendously I gained by being her doctor. I hope you can hear that in how I talk about her. I would not have had that would I have been her internist with detached concern. It would have been unavailable to me. So I just simply feel sorrow toward my colleagues who, in the effort to save themselves some pain, also prevent themselves from getting the joy. And I think gradually we are learning that. You know what it takes? Slight bursts of joy.